BDWPS.com and BDWPS Podcast. This is Year of the Iggy, a podcast series that tells the story of Iggy Pop over the course of a year. My name is Andy, and I'll be your host throughout this audio journey. If you like what you hear on this month's episode, I'd encourage you to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher. Just search Year of the Iggy. Also, remember to rate, like, and share the podcast with others that might enjoy it. On this month's episode, Iggy Pop and the Stooges push their boundaries to the limit. In the fall of 1970, Iggy Pop and the Stooges were at a crossroads. Not only had Iggy kicked bassist Dave Alexander out of the group, but the band's status with Elektra Records was also in limbo after releasing two albums with meager sales. Despite Alexander's exit, the band still had performance dates to meet. In just a few days, the band's roadie, Zeke Zettner, learned a handful of the band's songs, and they headed to New York City for several nights of shows at Ungano's. These were to be make-or-break gigs for the band, since many of the higher-ups at Elektra Records would be in the audience. Here's a clip from one of those shows. Down on the street where the faces shine, floating around on a real old mind. I see a pretty thing, they don't walk. I see a pretty thing, they don't walk. One night, Elektra Records art director Bill Harvey came out to see the Stooges and was met by a defiant band backstage. Iggy, who had dabbled in heroin use months earlier, was jonesing for a fix. He told Harvey that the band would not play the gig that night without $400 from the label, with the money, of course, being intended for drugs. Harvey reluctantly provided the band with the requested money, but looking back, he said that was the moment he quit being a voice of support in keeping the Stooges signed to the label. Even Danny Fields, their biggest cheerleader, couldn't help but feel let down by how much drugs had taken a hold over the band.
They were descending into a miasma of out of control and drugs and occasional performances.
While the Stooges' performances in the summer of 1970 were some of their most iconic, as talked about in last episode, the shows that came in the fall would be some of the band's lowest moments.
We'd all smoke ourselves silly. Later, started taking LSD before I'd work, and then there are stimulants, and then there are various depressants. And from that time on, things started to go downhill. Things started to break up.
Once back at the Funhouse, the dynamic within the band had changed. Iggy and Scott's addiction quickly turned their humble farmhouse into a drug haven. To make matters worse, a letter arrived in the mail informing them that the Funhouse would be bulldozed in the spring of 1971 in order to build a highway. With the legendary party house quickly becoming a crack house, Ron became the voice of reason within the band, but he couldn't do much to stop his housemates from spiraling further into addiction.
I'm going, gee, I think I'll play the piano today. Huh? It's gone, traded for dope. Equipment started missing. Then there were no practices. And it was just, we went through the motions of playing only to make money to get drugs.
During moments of clarity, Iggy realized he was throwing away his future in music. In a decision that he made solely on his own, he invited his drug buddy, guitarist James Williamson, into the band, thinking the Texan's guitar style would complement the band's sound. Needless to say, Ron was not happy about the addition.
James and Iggy had gone through heroin buddy deals together, you know, and he was, at that time, supposedly a more accomplished guitar player, and Iggy just wanted to try something different.
A new guitarist came in who could play Johnny B. Good. He was a troubled youth from the Detroit area also.
Excited about the new possibilities with Williams in the fold, Iggy decided it was time to clean up. In the winter of 1970, he flew to Jamaica with a guitar and a tape recorder in hopes of weaning himself off heroin and writing new material. He also hoped to draw inspiration from the joyful sounds resonating from the Kingston Bay.
He's gonna have a soul shakedown party tonight. He's gonna have a soul shakedown party tonight.
Replacing his heroin intake with Jamaican weed helped Iggy focus solely on his music, writing several songs during his time in paradise. Back in the States, Iggy attempted to remain clean, but his efforts would only last a couple of weeks before returning to his heroin habits.
You know, one of the problems with it is it seems to destroy your ability to be calm. And the more you take it, the more susceptible you are to needing something in a stress situation.
With the band's chances of re-signing with Elektra Records in limbo, Danny booked the band a small tour in the spring of 1971 in hopes that they might be better off on the road away from the negative influences back in Michigan. When the band played a show in Chicago, Danny flew to town to check in on them. He quickly realized that things had gone from bad to worse.
I was in the bathroom looking for Iggy, time to get ready. And I looked under the stalls, and there was Iggy lying on the floor, passed out with a needle in his arm. He was a junkie. He was a junkie. He was on heroin.
Reflecting on that night, Danny Fields said, quote, "Iggy's supposed to be on the stage, and you're pulling a needle out of his arm, and there's blood squirting in your face. Meanwhile, Alice Cooper and his band are adjusting their false eyelashes and powdering their noses in the same room. And I'm thinking, those Alice Cooper guys are not as good as this band, but they're pros. Both bands were playing for $1,500, and there's one poised for stardom and one poised for the floor of a bathroom." After the show, Danny Fields informed the band that he was done working with them. Here's Ron Ashton.
Danny Fields, who was managing us, just said, "That's it. I can't do anything. It's over."
The Stooges knew Danny Fields was the only person at Elektra Records who had their back. Without Danny, their chances of recording another album was all but sunk. With several gigs left on the tour, the band decided they would finish their dates and then go their separate ways. For Ron Ashton, the only clean member of the group, the decision to call it quits was devastating.
Well, I really thought the Stooges had a chance to be like the American Rolling Stones. You know, and I really put a lot of time and energy, and I never wanted it to, you know, go away. And I know I was, under certain circumstances, would stop something. But that, for me, the chance not to continue on with something that I think would have been really still happening today, how much better we would have gotten and grown. I miss not seeing it reach its full potential. But then again, maybe it did.
At the band's final tour performance in a small New York club, Iggy Pop came out to the stage covered in baby oil and glitter. During the encore, an audience member yelled, "Let's see you puke!" On command, Iggy walked to the front of the stage and vomited toward the heckler. It was a fitting end to a disastrous tour. Days later, Iggy returned to Ann Arbor, tired and broken.
Shame. Eventually it, you know, wrecked my health mentally and physically, and wrecked what we were doing with the band.
After crashing on friends' couches for a few weeks, Iggy was brought into custody for writing $2,000 worth of bad checks around Ann Arbor. Once again, his father would be summoned to bail him out. His father also gave him an ultimatum: clean up, or it would be the last time he came to the rescue.
My parents were very friendly with a pharmacist who completely illegally, without a prescription, ordered a bottle of liquid methadone for my exclusive daily use. It was a couple of miles from our trailer on the edge of Ann Arbor, and I would usually walk in the morning over there to take a small dose that he would personally give me from this family pharmacist. I got to the point I could go a few days.
Iggy's stay at his parents' trailer was a much-needed refuge for the young singer. On a diet of methadone and his mother's cooking, he slowly nursed himself back to health. But as his body rejuvenated, his mind became restless, spending his days wandering around the trailer park, disconnected from his friends and his music. That fall, Iggy's prayers would be answered when he received a phone call from Steve Paul, a wealthy New York club owner who he'd met through Danny Fields. Paul informed Iggy that he was interested in jumpstarting his music career as a solo artist. While Paul was an outsider in the world of music, he'd found success a year earlier when he used his connections to land blues guitarist Johnny Winter a $600,000 advance from Columbia Records. Soon after, Iggy and his girlfriend at the time, Betsy M., had first-class tickets to New York City, where Steve Paul would wine and dine them for the next several days. Paul's pitch was basically this: "You were great with the Stooges, so just imagine how amazing you'd be with actual musicians." During one of their nights in the town, Paul had guitarist and songwriter Rick Derringer meet up with them to discuss a possible future as a band. Derringer was no flash in the pan, having scored a number one hit with his former band, the McCoys. "Hang on, Snoopy, Snoopy, hang on. Hang on, Snoopy, Snoopy, hang on." Eventually, conversations had advanced to the point that Steve Paul thought he needed to inform his friend Danny Fields that he was now working with his former protege, Iggy Pop. Fields was devastated. Despite breaking ties with the Stooges months earlier, he considered them his pet project. He also knew that Paul was going to take all of Iggy's authenticity and cake it in glossy production and masturbatory guitar solos. Thinking back, Fields said, quote, "At the time, I thought, if Steve makes Iggy the star I always knew he could be, I'll kill them both." Perhaps Iggy had the same fears about what Paul would do to his music, or maybe he used the wealthy club owner to get him a free trip to New York. Whatever the case, on the day they were scheduled to talk contracts, Paul discovered Iggy and his girlfriend were nowhere to be found. In fact, the young couple decided to take some of the allowance bestowed to them by Paul for their time in the Big Apple and use it to pay for an impromptu trip to Miami. Needless to say, Paul was furious. Years later, when Iggy released a snarling live cover of "Hang On, Sloopy," it was clear he saw the entire ordeal as a joke. "Sloopy lives in a very bad part of town. Everybody tries to put my Sloopy down. So hang on, Sloopy, come on, come on. Hang on, Sloopy, come on, come on. Just a little bit louder. Oh, just a little bit harder. Hang on, Sloopy, hang on. Hang on, Sloopy, Sloopy, hang on. Sloopy, let your hair down. Oh, let it hang down on me. Sloopy, let your hair down. Let it hang down on me. So come on, Sloopy. So come on, Sloopy. So come on, Sloopy. A little bit louder. When Iggy returned from Miami, he wasn't surprised to see that his deal with Paul had been rescinded, along with his housing. Like a dog with his tail between his legs, Iggy reached out to Danny Fields, who reluctantly allowed him to stay at his apartment for a few days before returning to Ann Arbor. One night, As the two were relaxing and watching a movie, the phone rang. It was a local rock critic named Lisa Robinson with some huge news. Here's Danny Fields.
Iggy and I were sitting on my bed. We'd fallen asleep. Some black and white Western. And Lisa called me and she said, oh, is Iggy with you? I said, oh, yeah. She said, well, I'm with David Bowie. We're at Max's. He really wants to meet Iggy.
At the time, David Bowie was not the megastar that he would soon after become. But riding off the success of his first radio hit, Bowie represented the future of music to insiders in the business.
This is ground control to Major Tom.
David was, his star was rising then, Iggy's was not, to put it mildly, and David became his benefactor and protector and musical champion.
Fields insisted that Iggy go and meet David Bowie and his manager Tony DeFries. Here's a TV interview from 1977 of Iggy and Bowie recounting that fateful night.
Where did you meet?
In a bar.
In New York.
In New York, yeah.
You sure?
We were both unrecognized at the time, so we had a lot to, you know,
in common.
But you were both interested in music.
Yeah. No, not music, really.
Whatever you call it.
You call it music. Yeah. Okay. What Jimmy was doing, I'd never seen Jimmy, really. Uh-huh. But I'd heard some of his albums, and it sounded like, I don't know, nihilistic rock. Uh-huh. It was nihilism.
But... Well, that's
which
true.
Fascinates me. I love nihilism.
Well.
As established in the first episode of this podcast, Iggy Pop was always a charmer. Over the course of the evening, he entertained the two Brits with stories of growing up in Midwestern America, a region that was completely foreign to them. Meanwhile, Iggy was flattered by how big a fan Bowie was of his music.
David Bowie had listed the Stooges as his favorite American group late in the 60s. I was surprised that anyone on the planet Mars was listening to our group.
DeFries and Bowie had recently formed their own production company called Main Man Records, and by the end of the night, they inquired Iggy about the possibility of recording a solo album for them.
I went down there and met this manager, Tony DeFries. Met David, who was cool. They were going back to England. I went back to Detroit, and there was an understanding that at a later date, they would arrange for me to go to London to make some sort of a recording.
Part of DeFries' pitch was to find a British backing band to give him a new edge. Iggy, feeling a bit unsure about working with strangers, insisted that guitarist James Williamson come with him to London for the sessions.
But in the interim, I decided I wanted to retain my Detroit identity and told them in advance, you got to bring James Williamson with me.
I guess he was trying to capture the attitude that I had, which I did have quite a bit of attitude when I first started out. You know, I didn't really have any framework for anything. I was, not even 20 years old yet. And I I didn't have any skills, and so all I could do was play the guitar. I went from living on my sister's couch, literally, to getting a phone call from Ig and saying, you know, tomorrow we have a plane ticket for you and you're going to London.
In the weeks leading up to their departure for England, Iggy road tripped to James Place in rural Michigan to begin working on new material. One of the songs to come out of their jam sessions was Penetration.
I got a hold of a car, and it might have been my mother's, and I drove 50 miles from Ann Arbor to Birmingham, which was the suburb that James came from, and played me the riff to Penetration. And I said, that. From that riff, I was building fugues, basically. I thought, oh, well, then you could do this, or you could do that, or you could do these, or you could, you know, well.
Iggy and James worked on new songs, DeFreeze was busy trying to land a deal with a label. In a meeting with Clive Davis of Columbia Records, DeFreeze pulled a masterstroke, convincing Davis he could make Iggy Pop the star that Elektra Records had failed to pull off. Being a lifelong rival of Elektra, Davis decided to go ahead and give Iggy a second chance at attaining music fame. Weeks after the deal was complete, Iggy and Williams arrived in England, only to discover that they were instantly seen as outsiders by airport security.
So James and I got to Heathrow, and the cops took one look at us and thought, undesirable, no money. What are you doing? What do you mean you think you're not going anywhere? You're going into this holding tank. And it took us a while to contact DeFreeze on the phone, and he came down and signed for us. I don't think he ever really wanted us. I think David Bowie was interested in working with American artists who he admired at the time. I also think there was a bit of an American invasion planned.
Once free from the holding tank, Iggy and James were tasked with holding auditions for British rhythm sections that could back up Iggy's first solo effort. It didn't take long for the duo to realize that they weren't going to find artists with the same raw energy that defined Iggy's past work. Here's James and Iggy reflecting on the disappointing tryouts.
The first thing that they want to do is to put us together with an English band, rhythm section. So we auditioned a bunch of guys, and at the time, all the boys had big hair and frilly outfits, and I wasn't having any of it.
James said to me, look, these guys wear funny clothes. And he was being cute. But he said, look, these guys are just too different than us. He was really speaking for himself. But he had a point. I thought the only way that I was going to survive, or that we were going to survive as a force, was to be on the absolute modern edge.
After several days of failed auditions, Iggy contacted Bowie with a different idea on who could be his backing band.
I would have been polite about the backup musicians, but the names bandied about were people who'd already been in the Pink Fairies. When I investigated the Pink Fairies, it sort of looked to me like an amalgam of the ideas that had already been thrashed out by the MC5 and Alice Cooper. It wasn't right for us, I thought. I talked them into bringing two more Stooges over from America.
Here's Scott Ashton remembering the phone call from Iggy, asking them to fly out to England to reunite.
When he called and asked me and Ronnie to join him in England, we were more than happy. We didn't hesitate.
I'd multiplied. Basically, this is like cell division. The one became two, and then the two became four. And there we all were, and they had the Stooges were in Dodge. Happiness is a guaranteed.
While the Ashtons were excited to get the band back together, there were a couple caveats that didn't set well with Ron. First off, the album was to be considered a solo venture for Iggy. The album would be released under the name Iggy and the Stooges. The second gripe Ron had arose when Iggy informed him he would be playing bass on the album and not guitar like he'd done on the prior two albums.
He had been an incredible bass player in the Detroit area.
Oh, okay.
Pretty, you didn't know that. Unsung. He was a bass player when I met him. And he and James had played in the same high school band at different times.
Just days after the Ashtons arrived in London, the band was informed that Main Man had scheduled their first show outside of the United States. The label had planned what was to be a Main Man showcase, featuring artists from their label, including Lou Reed and the Tots. The show was also the debut of David Bowie's new persona, Ziggy Stardust, as chronicled in my podcast Year of the Bowie. While this was clearly a major moment in the story of David Bowie, the Stooges' performance that night in front of the British crowd might be even more important in terms of its influence on the world of music. Here's rock photographer Mick Rock on the legendary performance.
When he hit the stage, it was like nothing I'd ever experienced before, and it was a little intimidating because he didn't know, there hadn't been anybody around that had that attitude that was so in your face and so fuck you and so defiant. I think that's in a way that it took people a little time to realize that he was the progenitor of punk.
The crowd at the Stooges' performance may have been scant, but many of the onlookers would go on to define what we know today as the punk rock movement. One of those attendees was a 16-year-old named John Lydon. 2 years later, he'd take the world by storm with his band, the Sex Pistols. But it was on that night that he first witnessed punk rock at its purest form.
I love that growly voice. Oh my God, I'd never heard that in rock music. Just ripping it up. And there was this like hardcore in your face, violent sound that absolutely upset everything inside your head. Loved it. I thought it was the essence of pure hardcore rock. Not rock and roll, rock.
Another person at that show was Mick Jones, a young singer-songwriter who would go on to form another important cornerstone in the world of punk rock in the band The Clash. Reflecting on that life-changing concert, Jones said, quote, "The full-on quality of the Stooges was great. They were like flamethrowers." Viv Albertine, who would go on to form one of the first all-female punk bands, The Slits, was also in attendance. Here she is reflecting on the power of that night.
Iggy Pop was very revered, and he embodied the whole punk spirit for me. And when he came across to London, it was so exciting.
Don Letts, a musician and director who would play a big role in capturing the punk rock movement with his films, also attended the show and had this to say about Iggy's impact on the British rock scene.
But if you trace everything back, man, all roads stop with Iggy Pop. He struck a chord with the UK punk movement like no other American band.
That night's performance lit a spark that would ignite a cultural movement across Britain. 2 days later, the Stooges were in the studio recording an album that would douse gasoline onto the cindering flames that would soon be the punk rock movement. The Stooges record one of the most influential albums of all time on the next Year of the Iggy.
Keep walking cheetah with a hat full of napalm. I'm the runaway son of the nuclear A-bomb. I am the world's forgotten boy, the one who searches and destroys. Honey, gotta help me, please.
If you enjoyed today's episode and don't want to wait another month for the next installment, go check out the other seasons of the Year of the Podcast series. For the David Bowie story, search Year of the Bowie. For the Neil Young story, search Year of the Neil. For the Joni Mitchell story, search Year of the Joni. And for the Stevie Wonder story, search Year of the Stevie. All four seasons are available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Google Play. You can also check out my monthly podcast called BDWPS Podcast, where I play some of my favorite new music coming from the underground. If you are interested in exploring any of the interviews, songs, or research materials used in this episode, a works cited list can be found at bdwps.com. Also, remember to follow us at BDWPS on Twitter and Instagram for the latest podcast news. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you in a month.